This is Inside Open Wheel with your host, Jeremy Scott.
From the Trackout Multimedia Studios just outside of Chicagoland, this is Inside Open Wheel. Hello, everyone. I'm Jeremy Scott. Again, sorry about last week. We had a very powerful derecho that moved through the Chicagoland area right after we finished recording the last week's edition of Inside Open Wheel. Because of that, we really couldn't bring you anything because here at the studios, we didn't have power till late Wednesday night, didn't have reliable internet until the weekend, so at that point, we decided just to scrap it and prepare for this week's episode. It is a huge episode. It is our Indianapolis 500 preview. The 104th running of the Indianapolis 500 presented by GameBridge is going to happen this Sunday. So joining us with IndyCar analyst Nick Yeoman is his cohort on the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network. It's the voice of the 500, Mark Jane. So three of us are going to sit down, go over what happened last week in practice. We're going to talk about carb day, race day, and kind of the general feel within Gasoline Alley. Going to talk about a couple other things that also come up as well. Especially the new entitlement sponsor. This is something that's been kind of hush-hush for a while, but we're really happy to see that Pennzoil has joined on board to IndyCar Radio and the IMS Radio Network. So we'll talk about that a little bit as well. Also, in between our little discussion with Mark Janes and Nick Yeoman, going to have Hunter Yaney. He's one of the hottest drivers in F4. Now we know FR America's, you know, Linus Lundqvist, he's up near the front, but it's about a 3 or 4 car battle for who's going to win a championship. Hunter Yaney won the first and the last races at the last round at Barber Motorsports Park. So we're going to talk to him, see what this youngster is up to, what he aspires to do, and talk about that fantastic finish that he had. Really, most of the finishes that he had were pretty fantastic as well. As always, you can email us at InsideOpenWheel@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at InsideOpenWheel. Also, you can leave us a voicemail on our voicemail account at 815-714-9260, 815-714-9260. So this weekend, alongside the Indianapolis 500, the Road to Indy is going to be at the Lucas Oil Raceway Park, which is the old Indianapolis Raceway Park in Clermont on the Oval. They've got the Freedom 50 for the USF 2000 and the Freedom 75 for the Indy Pro 2000. They'll run on Friday night. Our friend Rob Howden will have the call on that on the Road to Indy TV app and on the Road to Indy TV website as well. Always a great time to see the stars and cars coming up from the Road to Indy on the short bull ring at Lucas Oil Raceway. If you've never been there, highly recommend you swing out there. I know that they're going to have some restrictions with COVID-19, as we're going to see at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, with unfortunately no fans in attendance. One thing we're going to talk about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway also, Ben Hanley at the last minute, he and the Dragon Speed team decided, yeah, we're going to run. So they are in the field. All 33 cars qualified for the race. We'll talk more about that here in just a couple of minutes. Outside of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the Indianapolis metro area, Formula Race Promotions racing at Summit Point in West Virginia. They're going to share the track with Woodbridge Karts throughout the weekend. F2000, F1600, they're going to run. So F1600 has three races this weekend. F2000 with two races. We'll follow that up next week. We'll see if we can get somebody on to talk about that. But Friday, basically, it's just practice all day with qualifying at the end for 1600s and 2000s. F1600 race one, half-hour race at 9:55, 2:45 on Saturday for race number two. F2000s, they run at 11:05, all times Eastern, for a 30-minute race. And then on Sunday, again, more 30-minute racing. F2000 starts out the day for Formula Race Promotions at 9:25, 1600s at 10:40. And I'm sorry, qualifying for 2000s is at 9:25. Their race is at 12:30. So I'm going to see if the Rice Race Prep can do something or if Team Pelfrey has anything for Rice Race Prep. Also, a lot of other things going on. We know now that Worldwide Technology Raceway will have fans at the races. This comes on the heels of Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker limiting what that Metro St. Louis East region can do. That he said that restaurants can't stay open past 11. He's limited size capacity for groups, but that's indoors. outdoors. It sounds like 25% capacity will be at Worldwide Technology Raceway for the doubleheader. That's the weekend after the Indianapolis 500. Try and get somebody on from WWT Raceway to talk about that. Other than that, really, we're really excited to get ready for this Indianapolis 500. And coming up next, Mark Janes and Nick Yeoman join me. We're going to start to talk about the 104th running of the world's greatest race at the world's greatest race course. Next on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, we're talking about the 104th running of the Indianapolis 500 presented by Gainbridge. And we can't do that without our IndyCar analyst, Nick Yeoman. Nick, I've got to say, it's been a weird week, to say the least. And we're having issues with Nick Yeoman. So what I'll do now is I'll bring in the voice of the Indianapolis 500 from the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network. It's Mark Janes. And Mark, we know Nick has problems. We know he's having problems. What do we say about this? I mean, we got to stick him up in turn one on Sunday.
Well, you know, technology is a wonderful thing when it works, and when it doesn't, it's absolutely excruciating. So hopefully at some point we'll have Nick with us. But, yeah, we're all catching our collective breaths after an interesting, compelling weekend of qualifying and now turning our sights to Carb Day and then ultimately to the 104th running of the Indianapolis 500.
And let's talk about practice, though, first. We lost today. We knew that early on. But how have the teams fared knowing that they're going to had that one less day, plus the extra Monday that they would normally have was moved to Sunday because you didn't need the last row shootout?
I mean, I think they'll all tell you they always wish they had more track time, and there's, you know, a handful of teams, namely Team Penske, that wish, I'm sure, they had more track time. But I think given all the variables and given where we are from an economic standpoint and given the fact that, the schedule was shortened a bit for a number of reasons, I think Mother Nature cooperated, and I think teams got three good days of practice, and I think the thing that threw the curveball at them was after they qualified on Saturday, you come back on Sunday and the humidity level drops and the wind picks up. And you look no further than the issues that caused and the fact that Andretti was poised to feel comfortable like they were going to lock down the front row and maybe have the four fastest qualifiers come race day. And Marco's now carrying the banner. I mean, yeah, they got those guys in the fast nine, but yeah, I think even Michael said after he was done celebrating Marco's pole win that he wasn't in a very good mood until Marco came in and shot a lightning bolt through that team and really pumped him back up big time. So, the shortened preparation for qualifying and the qualifying format itself, I think, really had the engineers earning their keep. And I think there's, quite frankly, some drivers still scratching their head, not 100% sure as to how the car is going to behave on race day.
One of those is a two-time Formula One world champion, Fernando Alonso. We'll talk about that. But I want to go back to qualifying, especially because Saturday we saw that Andretti locked out the top four, but that final run by one Scott Dixon maybe set that team on its head.
Yeah, I think I mentioned at the time that that was just the Iceman being the Iceman, and I think that was Chip being Chip. And, you know, the longer we talked about it and thought about it, it's just, I'm sure Chip enjoyed walking back through the garage area and walking by Michael and giving him a wink and a smile. And I think you go back and have the discussion on Sunday that we had with Mike Cole of Ganassi Racing, and I think what it boiled down to is a lot of confidence in the race car. And I think they wanted Marco to have to come and get them. And I don't think Scott Dixon had any interest in going out last on Sunday because, quite frankly, to be the fastest on Saturday garners you some headlines and gets some people to talk about you, but it doesn't pay one red cent. And he knew he was going to end up with a good starting position. So, I mean, he felt comfortable with his plan, and I think if you look at what they've accomplished statistically over the years, we're none of us in a position to second-guess the decision they made for sure.
So we also have some developing news. We're going to talk about that in the second half of this interview. We're talking with Mark Janes, Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network lead anchor, voice of the Indianapolis 500. Nick Yeoman is off somewhere, and we'll get back to him. I think he's probably still at 16th in Polco trying to figure out how to get back in the speedway. But I will say this, one thing that's interesting, one Chevy in the Fast 9, and it wasn't even a driver who's been there multiple times. It was rookie Renus VK who ended up carrying the Chevy banner in Fast 9. Granted, it was in an Ed Carpenter car, but not too surprising for that. But surprising we didn't see at least Ed in the Fast 9.
Yeah, kind of a reversal of fortune from qualifying a year ago. And, I think Scott Dixon and Alexander Rossi and a couple of others made that observation that, Honda was a bit frustrated. The Honda team's a bit frustrated at the dominance by Chevrolet in qualifying a year ago. But clearly Honda had upped their game. And certainly pole position is very, very important for them and the battle for the manufacturer's championship. Sometimes people forget how important that is to Honda and Chevrolet. I mean, that's their bragging right. I mean, they want to win the Indianapolis 500 and they want to win the manufacturer's championship. But, a lot of things can happen over 200 laps. And, I think Chevrolet certainly is known for, their success at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway going all the way back to its infancy. And, this competition is healthy. It's nice to see Honda maybe dominate one element one year and Chevrolet dominate one element the next or that same element the next. So that the competition's good, and hopefully in the not-too-distant future we'll get a third-engine manufacturer.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that because I know some of the rumors have been that Penske is talking to a third manufacturer, a prancing horse out of Italy. How has the talk been around Gasoline Alley this past week about that?
Well, I'm just going to say it like it is. That's a question I'm not able to answer because of COVID-19 restrictions. I don't have access to that area. I'm allowed to get out of my car, go to the booth, and then when the show's over, I leave the booth, go back to my car, and drive home. But I think much has been said about it, Jeremy. There's no question. And I will say this, if there's not a third engine manufacturer within the next year or two, it won't be because Roger Penske and Mark Miles and Jay Fry and the technical staff haven't tried. But I think people sometimes lose sight of the fact that it's just not as simple as wanting one. It has to make sense for not only the series, but it has to make sense for that engine manufacturer. I mean, there has to be not only commercial, but there has to be business gain for them in it. I mean, a lot of businesses in this series now and sponsors are business to business. They're not necessarily, business to consumer sponsorships like you see in NASCAR. That's what of the many things that makes open wheel racing so different. And sometimes some people say, well, they just need to go get a third engine manufacturer. Hey, nobody wants that more than Mark Miles and Jay Fry, but you really have to have some understanding of the business world before you have to, I think, really address as to why it hasn't happened. And there are a lot of perfectly reasonable explanations as to why it hasn't happened, but certainly desire is not one of the reason. It's not for lack of trying, and I think those efforts are ongoing and have been since it was just Honda and Chevy. Let's not forget, it wasn't all that long ago that Honda was supplying every engine in the series. Chevrolet went away for a while. And so the fact that they came back and brought some competition to the mix, I think, is fortunate. And certainly all of us hope that it expands someday soon. And I know Honda and Chevrolet hope it expands as well because they're not afraid of competition.
So, and exactly, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens because, I remember those days of Honda only when Chevy said, we're just not going to come back and, run. But nonetheless, we've seen how good Honda can be at the Speedway. We've seen how good Chevy can be at the Speedway. This is one of those years where it seems like Honda has the four-lap pace, but it looks like that Chevy, they're very competitive on that shorter pace. Case in point, you take a look at rookie Alex Palou for Dale Coyne Racing, gets the car in row three, but you take a look at drivers who we normally see at the front, Sage Karam and Jarrett Hildebrand, they're all the way in the last row.
Well, I think for Sage Karam and J.R. Hildebrand, Dreyer and Reinbold Racing, I think what they're finding out is how difficult it is with this aero kit to do a one-off. There's just so much data that teams have throughout the first four, five, six races of the season that they just don't have a lot of access to. I mean, I know that Dennis looks to expand that schedule each and every year, but that's a big, big mountain to climb against some race teams that have a lot of data and a lot to go on. And while certainly I know JR and Sage have no interest in starting in the last row, they're thankful to being in the field. And I think what I heard throughout the course of Saturday with qualifying is that the drivers like Sage Karam and JR Hildebrand and others maybe who didn't have the speed for the fast nine and maybe weren't going to find themselves in the fourth or fifth rows really spent a lot of time working on finding the balance to their race car and worked on long runs and because they understand that 200 laps takes a while and it's as they say it's a marathon and not a sprint. So I won't say it was an advantage because you don't want to start back there. There's a lot of bad things can happen. A lot of things can happen. Very few of them are good when you start that rear that far back in the field. But I think when you resign yourself to the fact that you're probably not going to be in the fast nine, I think you start working on the balance and you're working on a race car that you know you can compete with and maybe work your way through traffic. Maybe you get a little creative with your pit strategy. There's a lot of things you can do to maybe hang around and secure a top 10 or a top 15 finish, which I think would be huge for either one of those guys. And that race team and both of those guys are very capable of doing it. Because don't forget, the overwhelming majority of that team, even though they're not racing week in and week out, Dennis Reinbold keeps those guys together all year long. And Sage and JR have been with him for a few years now at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So I'm sure they've got a pretty good plan together. And as long as mechanical gremlins don't bite them, they could be in for a decent day.
And I was going to say, we do know that people have come to near the front from the last row before. Scott, your 1992. Mark, we're going to take a quick break. Coming up next, I sit down with F4 driver Hunter Yaney. We talk about his fantastic start to the season and his two wins at Barber Motorsports Park next on Inside Open Wheel. The wait is over. Inside Open Wheel is now on Apple Podcasts. So no matter where you get your favorite podcast from, you can always get a new episode of Inside Open Wheel on that same program. Heck, you can even get a push notification right when we release new episodes. Once again, Inside Open Wheel, we're now on Apple Podcasts.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
We talked about this last week. This driver that we have now on bookended the Formula 4 weekend by winning two races, darn near coming close to a third. And really, all three races, he finished in the top 10 in a very competitive Formula 4 championship. It's Hunter Yaney. Hunter, thanks for joining us. And really, for your first season, full season of big car racing, really can't ask for much more.
Yeah, it's great to be here. The first half of the season has gone great. We've won five out of the, I think, nine rounds now. Nine rounds. So, I can't really ask for much more than that.
No, and, it's very competitive racing. And let's talk about Barber real quick. Because, as I said, all four races you finished in the top 10. Three of them you're on the podium. You darn near won against Spike Hulbecker in race three. Which, by the way, that was a really good battle near the end.
Thank you.
Got to give you a lot of confidence going into the final three, going into the second half of the 2020 season.
Barber gives me a lot of confidence after scoring three of the podiums. It was a really good weekend. We qualifying got rained out, so that meant we started in our spots that we are in for the championship. I was going to be starting on pole, but unfortunately we got a three-place grid penalty, which put me back to fourth. Race one went really well. We made it up to first place from fourth. We got past Cade on the first lap on the start. yeah, it was a great weekend. That Battle of Spike was probably my best race in the season so far. He was really hard to get by, but it was a good point.
I will say, you did get really closer going into turn six, but the move that I thought was interesting was trying to get around the outside in the S's around Spike. Now, those who didn't see, the times when Hunter Yaney tried to pass Spike Hulbecker, Spike forced him to the outside. And were you questioning that move if you were going to be able to make it on the outside of the S's?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a sketchy move. but if you're going to go for the win, you got to go. And Barber's not really like the type of track where it's easy to pass there because it is a motorcycle track. There's a only really like reasonable places to pass are into turn five and turn eight. So it's a pretty hard track to pass around.
Yeah, you gotta go for what you can. You took the points lead in Virginia. The first weekend at Mid-Ohio, obviously, that was first for everybody. So talk about, I know you ran an F2000 race last year, but talk about moving from karting up to Formula 4.
Well, how I got into Formula 4 was at Supernats in 2017. I met my engineer, Dan, and he let me sit in an F4 car for the first time. It's actually the one I'm racing this season. He said, "You think you're ready to race one of these?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Okay, then." And then about a year and a half later, I did my first test in an F4 car, and I loved it. And he taught me how to read data. He went over video with me and went over how I could get better in most places, and he taught me car control, all sorts of stuff.
Now, how is learning, you know, looking at data, you know, each session, and how is that translating into improving your driving style? Because I can imagine it's got to be different being in something enclosed compared to a kart where you're mostly open.
Yeah, it is very different. I never really felt very comfortable in a go-kart because it just didn't have any seat belts and nothing to protect you from flying out of the cart. And the car has seat belts. It's very safe. I had to get used to it being a much bigger car, a much bigger thing to wheel around compared to the go-kart, because the go-kart just has like two little wheels right behind you, whereas you have a whole like 6-foot rear end behind you to get used to.
Hunter Yaney joins us here on Inside Open Wheel. I've got to ask you too, the F4, it is, you know, obviously what is in essence a stock motor, 165 horsepower. So it's a little bit heavier on you, but you also have that downforce, and a lot of drivers, you know, they don't get a chance to go straight into a downforce car. So talk about that first time you're on track, having all that downforce, you know, trying to get used to it.
I did my first test at Roebling Road, and that was one of the first things Dan mentioned to me is this car has downforce, and the faster you go, the more grip you'll have. So I went pretty fast, and it's pretty easy thing to figure out, a lot harder when you're driving in an F3 car, because the F3 car has much more downforce than the F4. But yeah, it's a pretty good tool in the Formula cars.
Now, you've got a month and a half off between your next race, which is Sebring International Raceway. First of all, let's talk about this long layoff. How are you going to prepare? Are you going to be able to test? Are you going to be doing a lot of sim work? You know, obviously in balancing schoolwork, I can imagine it's going to be a little bit easier for you this season because, you know, most schools are going to a work from home sort of deal. So that's going to make it a little bit easier on you this season.
Yeah, it'll make it a lot easier. I'm at Barber Motor. I'm at Barber right now with Skip Barber, testing some of their cars for them. But once I get home, I'm gonna relax for maybe like a week and a half or something, and then I'm gonna start getting back into the rhythm again of practicing and getting ready for Sebring and Homestead and the rest of the season.
We'll talk about that Skip Barber opportunity, because someone who's watched Skip Barber over the years, kind of interesting to see. Your next track is Sebring. And it's a bit of a rough track. You go from Sebring straight over to Homestead Miami Speedway, and so they're real close together. What are you going to do? Are you obviously you're staying down in Florida to prepare, but how can you prepare for two races just that close together?
Well, the week before Sebring, I'll probably get prepared by drinking water, just getting very good sleep, starting to get back into the rhythm of like how I'm going to be good. Think about the weekend. Obviously, Sebring and Homestead are very different tracks, different track surfaces. Like Sebring has some like airport pavement, which will be very bumpy. I've never been to that track before, but it'll be interesting to see how it goes. Homestead is a great track. I've drove on that and I won 3 times there in the winter series, the Academy winter series. I really like the track. It's a great facility.
Now, what are your plans? I know that, you know, F4 first season, what are your plans? Not only next season, but where do you want to take this career?
I'd like to take, if I win the championship this year, I'd like to go to FR Americas next year and hopefully win that and move up to like something like Formula One. That's the top goal for me is Formula One.
All right, let's talk about your testing opportunity over at Barber Motorsports Park. It's a newer car for Barber, but it's a car that you're starting to get used to. It's the F4 car. Now, for those who are interested in the Skip Barber Formula Car Program, talk a little bit about that, the school and the racing series.
Yeah, the school is great. I see how they take a lot of time to go over where the students can do better, like car control, braking. They do braking exercises, and they teach you how the downforce works. Yeah, so they take a lot of time and effort to put in to make the best experience possible for you and to teach you how. I mean, thank you to Skip Barber for letting me come and test their cars. It's been a great time. I really like the cars here. It's an amazing experience.
Now, Hunter, if others want to follow your progress outside of, you know, what's being streamed online, how can they go ahead and take a look at that?
Oh, what'd you say?
I said if fans want to follow your progress online, how can they do so?
Oh, they can probably go to like F4US Championship. They can check that every so often. Maybe follow their page. I have a page. It's Hunter Ganey. On Instagram. I post a lot of stuff on there. Most of the time I post something daily about how everything's going throughout the weekend and in the off time. So yeah, you can, and Velocity Racing Development, you can check their page on Instagram as well. They'll keep you up to date with all of me and my teammates' progress up throughout the season as it goes on.
All right, Hunter Ganey, thanks for joining us, and good luck the rest of the season. Enjoy this little break in the schedule.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Inside Open Wheel, we continue our coverage of the 104th running of the Indianapolis 500 presented by GameBridge with our sit-down with Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network's Mark Shanes, the voice of the Indy 500, and our IndyCar analyst, Nick Yeoman.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
All right, so we've got Nick Yeoman, our IndyCar insider, with us. We were just talking about qualifying and all that. Before we get off of qualifying, I want to touch on a couple things. Mark Jane's also joining us from the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network. I did some research earlier today, and I noticed that the field average was 229.339, 1 mile an hour faster than last year, but still the second fastest qualifying time of all time. That fastest was a couple, I think 2017, when Ed Carpenter took the pole. So the windscreen, I mean, Nick, you've been with these drivers most of the season. What is the take of these drivers with the windscreen right now, especially at IMS?
Well, I think most of the guys are pretty impressed, not only with how it's held up and it's done its job to protect those guys, like we saw with some incidents at Iowa Speedway, but I think acclimating to being in the cockpit and the feeling of the race cars and the visual cues of what you're looking at out through that windshield, that screen. I think guys have, outside of the fact that it is quite a bit warmer inside the cockpits and they've been working on those cooling systems, I think most of the drivers will tell you that they haven't really seen it affect too much. Now, obviously, once we go racing on Sunday, we'll find out what kind of dynamics it throws at those drivers in terms of passing and using the draft. But, no, I think by and large, if you were to poll the paddock, I think guys are pretty happy with how that thing responded.
Mark?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to note that the speeds, I think, were aided by the additional boost on Friday and Saturday. I don't think we can discount that, and I think it was a good move given the added weight of that aero screen. And you know, it's funny, I think we're kind of like the drivers to the point, even though, you know, we've not had it for very long this season. I think as we said and do what we do and we look at our monitors, I mean, every now and then it dawns on me that the car has a different look about it. But by and large, I just think it's one of those things that we've gotten used to, and the drivers seem to have developed a level of comfort to it. And you know, I know the Louis Schweitzer Award was just announced to those who developed that, and I think we've already seen it work. I mean, we've seen a couple of pretty nasty accidents, and we've seen the benefits of it already in terms of driver safety. And I think the series is to be commended, and all those involved for the safety measure. And I think they'll continue to massage it. And who knows a year from now if it looks the way it looks right now, but I think given all the variables and the relatively short amount of time it took to develop it, I think you got to give them a thumbs up for sure.
Two incidents offhand during practice that I can think of that really slowed down the process of practice. One of them was before qualifying, Fernando Alonso white-walling turn four, ran over the rumble strips. And we saw him do it last year, but obviously he qualified now. But the one that really made me scratch my head a little bit was Scott Dixon. I didn't know the guy was human. I never thought he made a mistake around I never thought he really made a mistake on his own around IMS.
Well, I mean, he was the first one to tell you that, yeah, that was on him. He got in just a little bit too high. And, you get up on the marbles, and especially on a day when it's a little bit on the gusty side. And I think to me, and Nick, feel free to weigh in, obviously, but I think what it indicates is you've got two of the best drivers in the world who show that at times that some might say, well, that's just them proving once again that they are human. I tie it to more the fact that those guys are always on the ragged edge, and sometimes they just tiptoe too far over the ragged edge, and that's the end result. But I think in the grand scheme of things, both incidents were relatively minor, even though they are a rarity from both of those drivers.
Yeah, both those guys, I think, pretty lucky. You don't wreck off of turn four very often without it being pretty big. But as you touched upon, you know, Fernando's issue was certainly looked like he just got a little too aggressive, a little low. And Scott Dixon's incident before qualifying was kind of bizarre. The lap speeds before he had spun out of four were way down. So I think it's just kind of a testament to that these cars at times feel best when they're being pushed to 230 miles per hour. And if you're trying to get those things up to speed and going around it at maybe 215, 220, that the handling goes away. And as you mentioned, that's a guy in Scott Dixon who we don't see make a lot of mistakes. So kind of a bizarre incident, but certainly both those drivers pretty fortunate that they weren't worse.
Now, Nick, I posed this question to Mark in the previous segment when we were talking about this, but we saw how the top four cars on Saturday were dominated by Andretti Autosport, and totally different front row stands from the pole sitter in Marco Andretti. Was it kind of a surprise, even given the conditions that we saw change from Saturday to Sunday?
Yeah, no, I heard Michael Andretti say that after the first three went out, Hinchcliffe, yep, Hunter Ray, and Rossi, and didn't post big laps, that there was no shot for Marco, so he was surprised by it. I think most of Andretti Autosport was surprised by it, but and kind of seeing those track speeds and seeing some of the data that was released, it certainly looked like that at about two, maybe three laps into that run, Marco wasn't trending for the pole position, and he put together a really monster fourth lap to get it, honestly, by inches if those two would have been side by side on the track. So, no, it was just a great run by Marco Andretti, And, you know, obviously Andretti Autosport has come ready to fight with some pretty good race cars. And just because they didn't lock out the front row like I think they would have liked to, I think Michael Andretti knows that there's a much bigger prize there. And certainly he's got a handful of drivers that know how to get it done.
All right, so let's start off with Mark. The race obviously starting later in the day than we normally have it. Obviously starting later in the year than we normally have it as well, but that's, you know, neither here nor there. How do you think it's going to play out, especially because it looks like we might have the same conditions that we normally do for a typical 500-mile race?
I don't think anybody knows, and that's, you know, part of the mystique of the Indianapolis 500. I've had, obviously, you know, with some of the struggles that he's had, especially over the last few years, the question I keep getting from people, I mean, is Marco for real? What's going to happen when the green flag flies? And I know I hate to preface it by saying if. Not just the first stint, but if he is still within the top five by the second stint of the race, that indicates to me that he's pretty comfortable in a race car, and I think he's got a shot. I go all the way back to 2006, his rookie year. At the time, Kyle Moyer was the president of Andretti Autosport, and he was Marco's race strategist. And I asked him at Phoenix if he thought Marco could win races in the IndyCar Series, and he said he'll win the Indy 500 this year because it suits his driving style. And, of course, he came within a few yards of doing just that until he was beat to the start-finish line by Sam Hornish Jr. And Marco's had some good runs at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway over the years. One of his wins is on an oval in Iowa, which is not at all similar. But I tell you, I saw something on Sunday in Marco that I don't know that we've ever had the opportunity to see, which gave me an idea that there's just something a little bit different about him this year. Before we went Fast 9 qualifying after the morning practice session, of course, none of those cars took part. Marco Andretti was out running around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And I don't know too many other drivers who were working out during that period of time, but I think that indicates a different Marco Andretti. And I think all of those variables come together for me to say that he's got a legitimate shot on Sunday.
Nick?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. And I think Marco is a guy who just, he needs that confidence, and I think when everything is lined up the way it has, I think Marco kind of feeds off of that. When we've seen countless times over the years where if that car isn't right and Marco's not happy with it starting practice session, no matter where we go on the IndyCar calendar, it becomes an uphill fight. Or if Marco struggles in qualifying, it seems like it's a struggle for them to get him to the field. So I think you've seen it kind of snowball a bit this week, and I think Mark's absolutely right. That first stint, if Marco doesn't start tumbling through the field and isn't hollering on the radio, if that car feels good for him at the very beginning, I think he's going to be a factor all day long. But it's a fantastic storyline. The Andretti name means so much to the Speedway. And, boy, I can't see if Marco could pull off a win after 500 miles, Jeremy.
It's going to be interesting. And I you know, people have asked me even, they're like, well, what do you think is going to happen? I look at him, I'm like, look, 20 drivers can win this thing this year. It's that wide open. So it's going to be interesting to watch, interesting to listen on the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network. Now, Mark, how the heck do people find out whether or not their station will carry the 104th running of the Indy 500? Oh, go ahead, go ahead.
I can take that one. Yeah, no, I know. If you go to IndyCarRadio.com, you'll see a list of all of our affiliate stations. We update that throughout the course of the year. So, yeah, it's all there, but lots of different ways as well, Jeremy, to listen. The TuneIn app has been fantastic. Of course, the IndyCar app,
yep.
Race Control, IndyCar on their website. So lots of different options, of course, SiriusXM as well. But, yeah, if anyone wants station information for local affiliates, IndyCarRadio.com is the place to go.
Yeah, put Rumpsa to work so we can have some old IRL races, the F1 races at Indy, the MotoGP races. Those are the things. I love listening to the Classic 500s. I love listening to the old, you know, IndyCar races from like 3-4 years ago, but I want to hear the races that, Nick, you and I grew up with, the side-by-sides at Chicagoland, you know, the Phoenixes, the Pikes Peaks. Those are the races I want to hear.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, that was it was the edge of your seat stuff with listen to Mike King and a lot of times Mark on the back stretch or in the turn going back and forth with some of those incredible finishes. So, yeah, we may have to sprinkle a few of those in from time to time for folks to hear.
All right, got one more quick break coming up, but we do have some breaking news I want to break with both of you guys and talk about a couple other things. You're listening to Inside Open Wheel. The wait is over. Inside Open Wheel is now on Apple Podcasts. So no matter where you get your favorite podcast from, you can always get a new episode of Inside Open Wheel on that same program. Heck, you can even get a push notification right when we release new episodes. Once again, Inside Open Wheel, we're now on Apple Podcasts.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network anchor Mark Janes, Nick Yeoman, our IndyCar insider, also joining us. All right, so here's the big story, the breaking news. Jimmy Johnson was just on the Dale Jr. Download, and I know it's poor form to promote somebody else's podcast. I get that, but this is huge news. Jimmy Johnson has just announced, Mark, that he is looking for funding to run the road and street course program for 2021 next season.
Yeah, I don't think he'll have any trouble finding it, really. I mean, I'm sure he could write his own check if he wanted to with a bank that he's made in his career in Cup. But you know what? I get it. I understand the excitement behind it. I've always been a fan of his because of his reference for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indy 500. And I know that like them all, he's a racer at heart. I think it'd be cool. I'm for anybody that wants to chase that deal that can put it together and do it and kind of be competitive to do so. I mean, again, it goes back to the conversation we talked about, Jeremy, with the engine manufacturers and the desire to have a third. You know, there's a lot of guys over the years that would have loved to have done the double, but if they're driving for a Toyota team, Toyota's not going to have them come to Indianapolis run a Honda or a Chevy.
No.
And, you know, if you are sponsored primarily by a particular home improvement store, you're not going to come to Indy and run for your competitor's team. I mean, there's so much to the business side of this. People just don't understand. It's not as simple as wanting it to happen. It's got to be in a way that makes sense. And for those drivers, quite frankly, they want to come here and they want to compete. They don't want to come over here and run laps. That's too much of a risk. And I don't care if it's the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, it's Barber Motorsports Park, or it's the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach. They want to come here and be competitive. So I understand that. But over the years, we've heard a lot of guys say that they're looking to put a deal together, looking for sponsorship to make something happen. And I'll tell you what, if Jimmy Johnson can't make it happen, that'll give you an idea just how daggone hard it is. But if it does, I'd say bring him on. I'd love to see him get out there and compete week in and week out, because I think he's one of the greatest that of all time at what he does, for sure.
And Nick, you and I have talked about Jimmy's lap times that we saw from Strava and how he would have been competitive if they had it in race setup, which I would imagine Ganassi would have set him up for race trim. So this news really to me isn't too surprising.
No, and let me just say, I'll be the first one to pony up the first $10, you know. I think it's a great story, and it's going to be fun to watch throughout the course of the off season, not just of how that funding comes together and if you can get a top corporate America sponsorship to jump on board, which, as Mark kind of alluded to, Jimmy Johnson's got a lot of connections. But ultimately, what team may reach out and jump on board and want to put Jimmy in one of those cars? So, no, he is, as Mark talked about, he's one of the best stock car drivers that NASCAR has ever seen. And to come over and possibly run an Indy car on the road and street circuits, I look at it from an Indy car perspective. You know, we don't usually need any help promoting the Indianapolis 500. That thing is its own beast. But boy, I mean, now all of a sudden the added bonus for fans that may come out, you know, hoping things are back to normal, to the normal road and street circuit calendar, a chance to watch Jimmy Johnson race. I think it'd be great. So, fingers crossed. As you know, there are oftentimes with these deals, a lot of T's to cross, a lot of I's to dot, and the dollars have to make sense. But, boy, I think it'd be a fantastic story.
Does this equate to something close of Mansell Mania like we saw in 93? That's the question I want to know.
I don't think it does because he wouldn't run full-time in the series.
Nah, fair enough, yeah.
You know, it might be a big deal if he was a full-time driver and competing for a championship for a 500 win. But, I mean, it's just a cool story is what it is. And I think Nick hit the nail on the head. You know, the Indy 500 typically doesn't need to be propped up. I mean, if A.J. Foyt said, you know, the old adage, A.J. Foyt didn't make the Indy 500. The Indy 500 made A.J. Foyt. And if that's the case, I'm with Nick. I think you have to look at him going to those road and street circuits that are already well attended. And boy, I tell you what, it's going to sell tickets because that's how loyal and dedicated that fan base is, and I'm all for that for sure.
So it's going to be interesting to see where he ends up. I wouldn't be surprised if somehow he ends up at Ed Carpenter Racing. A, it's a Chevy. B, he can end up at the 20 car, sharing the 20 car with Ed Carpenter. So it'd be kind of like you know the old guys team, although I know Bree Rents would probably smack me upside the head for that moniker. But nonetheless, very exciting news for IndyCar. Now, this season, obviously, has been very different. Let's take a look at a little insight with how the production is done this year. Nick, you go to all the races. You know, you're the main pit reporter. Sometimes you do have help. And Mark, you guys are still broadcasting from the Sid Collins booth in the media center, correct?
Well, we are in Indianapolis, but we're actually in the studios of IMS Productions on 16th Street, which is across from the main entrance to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. That serves as our master control for all of our races, with the exception of those that run at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And we are there with a multi-screen monitor. We are there with all the timing and scoring that we need, and have a turn announcer / co-host there. It had been Jake up until now, and for the races that we'll travel to the rest of the year, we're going to send Jake out on the road, and Nick is going to join me in the booth along with Davey Hamilton, our driver analyst, and our executive producer, Sam Rumsa, and our network director, Chris Pollack. And Jake will be out with, I think, a rotating cast of characters. I think Rob Howden is set to join him when we get to Gateway after the Indianapolis 500.
Sam Rumsa, God, you know, the kid who gets my name wrong on IBC when I fill in over with our buddy Tony Katz. So, you know, it's not the same as being at the track, but it's still got to feel good knowing that you're still calling races nonetheless, albeit, you know, you get to go home afterwards.
Well, I mean, there's a disconnect. I'm not going to deny it because, I mean, when a session's over, you don't get the opportunity to go find out maybe what happened. Sometimes your view is not what it is at the racetrack. If you get in a situation like we had, you know, when Alexander Rossi's car and Jack Harvey's car are identically prepared, sometimes the smaller monitors, it's hard to pick those cars up and distinguish between the two. And sometimes when you get a restart and you've got some cars on lap down in between the leaders, sometimes that's hard to identify. But I guess the ultimate compliment is the fact that most people don't realize that we're not there until we break the news to them. And I think that's a credit to not only technology, but I think the talent and professionalism of the people we work with, most namely our chief engineer, Rick Evans, who goes on site with the pit reporters, and he, along with BSI, who provides a lot of our production gear, they work in unison to make sure that we have the tools we need to do as close to the job that people are used to us doing as we can.
Yeah, because it almost reminds me of the setup you guys had with at least Japan, where I think you were in the were you in the studio with Mike King, and then they would send Patrick Stepan.
We did all the Brazil races that way. We did all of the Motegi races, but one. Mike King and I went over there once. Honda sent us over there one time to do it from Twin Ring Motegi, and then one year we did the Edmonton race that way. So I mean, it's not a new venture for us. I will say the setup we have now is a bit more effective because in those days we didn't have a multi-screen monitor. We had the raw production feed, the television fed, and so we would be calling a battle at Twin Ring Motegi, and all of a sudden TV had switched to a pit stop, and we just had to either try to make it up or go with them. So in that regard, it's better. But, you know, I've done a lot of high school games and you know, in all sports over the years, and I will say this, you know, I had the chance a few years ago in a semi-state game to call a last-second shot when Warren Central upset New Albany, and Romeo Langford. It wasn't really an upset, I guess, because Warren Smith was ranked number one at the time, but all the attention was on Romeo Langford, who eventually went to IU. And I know Nick's happy about the fact that that Purdue Boilermaker was one that hit the last second shot to beat him. But I would hate to think that I would have had to have called that shot from the studio, because Nick knows from being out on the course for a number of years and being on pit road. Boy, it's a different animal, because not only do the drivers and the participants feed off the fans, as broadcasters, we do too.
Yeah, and Nick, we wouldn't know about making it up as we go along at all, would we?
No. It's as Mark talked about, it's certainly different from being on site for the first handful of races and the access levels and, you know, like Road America and Iowa, where we did have spectators, and how certain areas were closed off, and the garage area was closed off, and the access level to the drivers was a little different as well. But, I think we're just kind of trying to make the most of it. It's a difficult situation, but, it could be a lot worse, as Mark talks about.
All right, Mark, we'll circle back with you later after the season's over. We'll do another roundtable, kind of wrap up the season that was, and yeah, definitely. We'll have you back on soon, because great talking with you as always, man.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the invite. Take care.
Nick, we'll talk to you after Gateway. We'll circle back, talk about the 500 Gateway and all the usual stuff, and hopefully the technical gremlins, I can beat these out of the computer.
All right, thanks, Jeremy.
And that does it for Inside Open Wheel. Hopefully you enjoy the Indianapolis 500. We'll see you next week. Take care.